skies forever.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. Unless we ask for calls, don't call in, because we have with us on the line Charlotte Isabey, who worked in the Department of Education during the Reagan years and, of course, realized that the Reagan administration was working to Sovietize the American educational system. And she begins leaking information about the educational program at that time that was aimed at intentionally dumbing down American children and merging the Soviet and the American educational system. Well, anyway, Charlotte has written a wonderful book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. But more so recently, why she has actually put up on her internet site something that I've always wanted to do and never got around to. Now I don't have to because it's up there. And that is the complete text of the Reese Committee Report. Now, to many of you out there in the listening audience, you've never heard of the Reese Committee Report. But it is one of the most important investigations ever carried out by Congress. It started out in 1952 after Eastern Europe and China had gone communist. And there had been a couple of congressional investigations to find out why these countries, why Eastern Europe and China had been turned over to the communists by our State Department. And as the congressional committees investigated, they found out that the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation had been financing communist organizations and communist activities and communist front organizations right here in the United States. And so that then led to the establishment of the Cox Committee in 1952, and they started the committee hearings, and then Congressman Cox died, as so often happens by those who begin looking behind the scenes. And at the end of that year, of course, the Republicans won the Congress. They controlled the Congress. And so when the Republican Congress convened in 1953, they appointed Congressman B. Carroll Reese of Tennessee to pick up the investigation that Congressman Cox had started and try to find out what the great tax-exempt foundations were really doing. This is the single most important investigation ever done. It's been totally suppressed by the mass media. We do carry a book written by the counsel for the committee, Rennie Wormser, called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. That book was suppressed. You see, the last thing the people who work behind the scenes want for the American people to know is the fact that communism has never been a threat. It has always been financed and encouraged and covered for and produced right here in America by some of the wealthiest people in America who needed an enemy so they could force the American people to rally behind the government here for their defense. Or as Plato said so well in his Republic, when the tyrant has defeated the enemy by treaty or by conquest and there's nothing to fear from him, then he's always out rousting up another enemy to rally the people behind him. Charlotte Isabey, thank you so very much for being there, and thank you for getting that up on the Internet.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on, Dr. Stan, and I'm pretty excited about that, too, and so happy that I can be on, and we can I can discuss this with someone who is so very knowledgeable. It's really a treat for me, and I said to my husband, it's good, because I just had a two-hour nap before I come on, and I said, well, you know, when I'm on with Dr. Stan, I don't really have to worry because I can let him do all the talking, because he's so interesting.
Hold that thought right there.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's Charlotte Isabey. Go ahead, Charlotte.
Well, I was just going to say that it's great to wake up. I just woke up from my two-hour nap. It's a little bit later here on the East Coast, and to come down and to be able to start an interview with someone who knows far more than I do about the subject that we're dealing with tonight, because you really have been dealing with this longer than I have, even. Although it has been, I suppose, I've been dealing with this one since, when did I find out about Norman Dodd? Probably in 1983, I believe. In 1983, yes. And I was absolutely shocked. I had dinner with him one night in Washington, and there's nothing like having a wonderful man like Norman Dodd tell you this incredible story across the dinner table.
Well, now, why don't you explain to our listeners who Norman Dodd is and why he, or who he was, and why he was so important?
Well, he was a great American, and he had been, you know, highly educated, if you want to call going to Yale Andover School and Yale University being highly educated. I think at that time it probably was when he went. And then he went on and he worked on Wall Street, and he did an extraordinary study, I believe, of the banking system when he was at the Morgan Bank, I believe he was at Morgan, and probably brought the truth out about the Federal Reserve. And the bankers there were very impressed with the work that Norman Dodd had done, but I guess they were quite surprised, too, when he was asked to do even more work on it, and it got to the point where he was told to stop working on it because it was not what the top people in the bank wanted or in the banking industry wanted. And so he subsequently, he left because they told him that he could stay on there and twiddle his thumbs, but he didn't want to do that. He felt that what he had found out was too important.
Well, now, what did he find out? What did Norman Dodd find out about the banking system that was so vitally important that they didn't want him to continue investigating?
Well, I guess he found out that the banking system is owned, it's a private bank, a cartel, and owned by a couple of hundred very, very wealthy American families that benefit from the incredible deficits that we have in this country, and that our money system was absolutely corrupt.
In other words, what he basically found out is that the our Federal Reserve is really a privately owned central bank that creates money out of nothing, that then can use that money to buy up industries, can use that money to buy up the media, to buy up politicians, and that really, of course, it is those who control the money who control the nation. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Charlotte Isbay was telling us about an opportunity she had had to have dinner with Norman Dodd. And, of course, I'd met Norman Dodd back in 1980, and Norman Dodd had been the chief investigator for the Reese Committee. In other words, the congressional committee that investigated the Great Tax Exempt Foundation needed somebody to be the director of research, so he got that job. And, of course, Norman Dodd really understood what was going on. He recognized that working behind the scenes was a small group of very wealthy people who had been financing communism, who had been financing anti-communism, who had been financing the right, had been financing the left, who had been financing the Republicans or the Democrats. And he then set out, through the courses of investigation, to try to pull this all together. And now he had money, he had a congressional staff behind him, and, of course, he was going to find out the truth about what the Great Tax Exempt Foundations were doing and help expose this cabal that had betrayed America, had betrayed the people of China, had betrayed the people of Eastern Europe, and had betrayed the people of Russia. So pick up the story there, Charlotte.
Well, so they took him on board as the research director, and he performed his duties admirably to the point where, as we said earlier, the investigation was brought to an abrupt halt. And I think that Congressman Hayes, who was in charge of it, he was the committee, actually, he told the Rennie Wurmser, you know, who wrote the book that you have, Foundations, that the White House had been in touch with him. And the White House had asked Hayes, that was Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, if, quote, he would cooperate to kill the committee. And so that tells us a little bit about the White House and President Eisenhower and the Republican Party as well. So that will tell us a bit about both parties. Neither party wanted this unbelievable information to get out that was coming out during the course of the investigation, the Reese Committee investigation.
Now, of course, the congressman was Wayne Hayes, and he would then come into the committee, and he would keep interrupting. During one 185-minute period, he interrupted the hearings 225 times. How could you do something like that? Well, very simply, he wanted to keep interrupting so nothing would come out. And, of course, the one thing they feared was going to come out, one of them, was the fact that the Rockefeller Foundation had funded the Kinsey investigation. In other words, Alfred Kinsey's investigation of sexuality in America, that was one of the things they really had to cover up. Because Kinsey wanted to destroy the moral fabric of our society. He was a homosexual. He was in favor of bestiality and pedophilia and pornography. He was a totally depraved individual, funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And one of the major thrusts of Wayne Hayes, Congressman Wayne Hayes, was to conceal that fact and prevent the American people from realizing the depravity that the Rockefeller Foundation and the Rockefeller family represented, and the danger to the survival of America as a Christian nation.
Well, that's absolutely true. And Wayne Hayes, the individual that he interrupted, it was 246 times during 185 minutes of testimony, was Aaron Sargent, who was brought in to testify in regard to the infiltration of education, and especially in regard to the trip to the Soviet Union by John Dewey and George Counts and numerous other individuals. Very, very incredible list that you will find when you go to the internet to read this testimony. Aaron Sargent, he kept interrupting him, and I mean, it's really shocking. I just couldn't believe that this could happen. And such sarcasm, unbelievable sarcasm. The questions that were asked were totally irrelevant, childish, sarcastic.
Well, because he was sent there to disrupt the congressional hearings.
That's right.
Because the last thing they could afford.
And I was amazed that it was Sam Rayburn, the most powerful Democrat at that time in the House of Representatives, had been assigned to the committee for one purpose, to break up the investigation. And I was really surprised to hear that. I had thought that Sam Rayburn was a pretty good guy. And they managed to break it up. But the point is that the 2,000 pages of the Reese Committee report are there.
All right, now I want you to tell our listeners how they can get that.
How they can get it. Well, they can go to, it's the secondary website that I have, because some of your listeners know my other one. My first website, which has all of my book and all my articles on it, is deliberatedumbingdown.com. So that's not the one to go to. I hope you'll go to it, because that's an important website. That's for my book, if you want to buy my book, The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. This website is called, and it's in its infancy, it's very, very small, because I set it up primarily for this and other very important documents that are difficult to get a hold of. It's called AmericanDeception.com. Two words together, AmericanDeception.com. And when you go there, if you are you have a PC, you're not going to have any trouble at all pulling it down. If you have an Apple, you won't have any trouble, but you have to have Adobe Reader for that. And it's fascinating. I have Adobe Reader, and what you can do is you can listen. You can listen to this voice reading the transcript of the hearings with Adobe Reader if you want. I mean, those of you who are technologically literate know how to do that. And it's pretty fascinating how it works. But I got into that website, and it's especially into the Reese Committee hearings. I also have the Cox Committee hearings up there. Don't forget, they're very important, too. That's only 900 pages. The Reese Committee is 2,000. Cox Committee is 900 pages.
Now, I think it's important that our listeners realize that this has been suppressed for 50 years. They do not want the American people to understand that the whole communist threat was a fraud. And, of course, poor old Senator McCarthy was absolutely right. There were communists working at the highest levels of our government and working in our White House. But they weren't the ones who were responsible for all the things that happened. The communists were never smart enough to question who was funding Russia, who was funding the world communist movement. And, of course, it was these same people that we've talked about so many times, and that's covered so well in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and the documentation is all there, including the quotation from the book, British Agent by Bruce Lockhart, who was set to Russia by Lord Milner to keep an eye on what Lenin was doing, and he found out that Lenin was totally subservient to him. He couldn't understand why Lenin would be subservient to him and to a man named Harold Robbins, who was working for William Boyce Thompson of the American Federal Reserve Bank. And Bruce Lockhart and Robbins would be taken into all the secret meetings of the Communist Party where they're making their decisions. And Bruce Lockhart couldn't understand that. That's why this is such a vitally important book. British Agent by Bruce Lockhart, written in the 1920s about his experience in Russia in 1919 and 1920. So when you begin to understand that we have backed communism all along, always pretending to be the enemy, sending our boys off to fight communism, but never really fighting it. We never tried to win in Korea. We never tried to win in Vietnam. We financed the North Vietnamese all during the Vietnamese War by lending massive amounts of money to Russia so they could lend it to the North Vietnamese to keep the war going. Otherwise, the war would have ended in a month or two. All we had to do was bomb the dikes or bomb the hydroelectric plants in North Vietnam. That would have ended the war. But just as what's going on in Iraq today, if we cut the funding off from the insurgents coming from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, which were funding, why the war in Iraq would end. But they don't want to end the war. They just want to keep us arguing about all the wrong issues. So pick up the story there, Charlotte.
All right. Well, I think that what's very interesting now for your listeners, those who are going to be going to that movie, Good Night and Good Luck, regarding Edward R. Murrow and his career as a radio broadcast journalist, newsman, very, very important, probably the most highly promoted and recognized news guy that the country has ever known, who reported out of Europe during World War II. His affiliation with the Communist Party is so clear, and the pages in here that people should look for when they go on the internet, it's easier if I tell them, are page 262 to 274 in regard to Edward R. Murrow's trip to Moscow University with George Counts, I believe, and John Dewey, etc., during the summer of 1935. And actually they point out that they're discussing the plan for that summer seminar. Mr. Sargent, who was interrupted so many times, had all the documents on this and the plan, which had been published, what they were going to, where they were going to go, where they were going to stay, who was on the list, and all. He had all of this, and Mr. Hayes kept saying, but all you have are this promotional material, Mr. Sargent, that's all you have. And Mr. Sargent pointed out, he said, well, all I can say is that it says right in here, in the promotional material, that these meetings took place in Moscow in 1933 and 1934, and the same meeting was going to take place with the students, American students, to be brainwashed at Moscow University in 1935, and all of these people were listed, including Edward R. Murrow. And Edward R. Murrow, evidently when he was asked, seemed he lied, and he said no, he had never been there. But the number of people that were listed was just extraordinary, and there are many, Stephen Duggan, the American, I just can read this, George Counts, National Advisory Council, Teachers College, Columbia University, John Dewey, Columbia, Stephen Duggan, Institute of International Education, Robert Hutchins, University of Chicago. It goes on and on.
Well, I think it's so important for people to understand that there are many, many people who were totally committed to communism. They really believed in the philosophy without ever realizing, of course, that philosophy was being pushed and encouraged by the very people they opposed. They saw the problems with capitalism, and of course they wanted to work against it without ever understanding that the very capitalists they opposed were supporting the philosophy they embraced. Well, this is right back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest, of course, is Charlotte Isabey. So pick up the story there, Charlotte.
Well, just like here, well, I'll just give you a little. I'm going to read a little bit out of here, out of the hearings. It says this is the chairman. This would be.
Now, this is 1953, 1954, and the chairman of the committee is Congressman B. Carroll Reese, so go ahead.
That's right, and so it goes on, it says, everybody who wants to come in will be given opportunity to speak. Okay, but again, it is my own feeling that regardless of whether the summer school of 1935 was held, the program from which Mr. Sargent is reading has an important bearing. And then we go on, he says, Mr. Hayes says, Mr. Sargent, would you mind if I took a look at the list? And so he shows him this list, and see if there are any other names I recognize beside Ed Murrow's. Certainly I don't mind. And then Mr. Hayes says, here's an example of what we're dealing with. It says, quote, the summer session originated as a result of an experiment conducted during the summer of 1933 by a group of American educators. The American summer school in Russia was organized to offer due courses dealing with, quote, experimental educational programs of the Soviet Union and institutional changes in the Soviet Union. This is the plan that was, this was published and sent out to all the universities. And, he says, now I can understand why the Russian government canceled this thing. That's what they said, it was canceled. It wasn't canceled. They never really came to a conclusion on whether it took place or not. Edward R. Murrow lied. It had taken place, though, 2 years before, so who cares, right? And, then he goes on, he reads the rest of the names. The remaining list of names was the president of Smith College, professor of sociology and director at North Carolina, Howard Odom, William Russell, Dean, Teachers College, Columbia University, goes on and on. And then it goes on, it says, the next page says, the tremendous progress of the Soviet Union in the cultural field creates for Americans an unequal observation ground for education, sociology, and the social sciences. This is part of the brochure, mind you. The Soviet Union presents a unique opportunity for the study of the process of cultural change. The first and second five-year plans, by creating the foundations of a planned economy, have brought about a complete reconstruction in the social attitudes and behavior of the Russian people. Goes on, the Soviet Union possesses the most progressive system of public education, extensively making use of the best achievements of international pedagogy. That's the method, right? Skinner, Pavlov. And then under purpose, it says that summer session is open to all academically qualified foreigners interested in the culture and educational aspects of life in the Soviet Union. The director of the Moscow University summer session is a Soviet educator. And in order to ensure close cooperation with American educational institutions and with students and educators in the United States, an advisory relationship was established in 1933 with the Institute of International Education.
In other words, what you're saying is that our educators were working with the Soviet educators.
That's right.
Because our educators were dedicated to this dream of socialism.
That's right.
And socialism is a sincere, idealistic, benevolent concept, but it doesn't work without force. Somebody's got to be in charge. The real problem with this whole issue, and the reason that people of great wealth wanted to create a socialist society in the United States, was because all power then would be centralized in Washington, D.C. Now, under our system of government, where freedom reigned, why the power of the central government was to be limited. But they wanted all power with one central point of government, and they would be able to then buy and sell the politicians and control everything. Under our decentralized system, it was extremely difficult to establish the dictatorship they sought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Charlotte Disobey. And Charlotte, Charlotte has been telling us about this meeting that was held in the 1930s, and Edward R. Murrow was there, and of course John Dewey, and many of the other educators from across America. And of course Wayne Hayes, Congressman Wayne Hayes, had been sent there to the Congress to be on the committee to disrupt the hearings. Why? Because he could not let the American people understand what was going on, or the part that the great tax-exempt foundations had played in funding communism, both here in the United States and in the Soviet Union. And, of course, the various Communist Front organizations are instrumental in bringing communism to China and communism to Eastern Europe. So the last thing that the average American was to understand is this whole thing was a charade. The whole thing was a sham. And, of course, today we understand it even better, understanding the spiritual forces that energized the people within these foundations. Andrew Carnegie, the Rockefellers, certainly the Fords. Henry Ford was involved with the occult. So was Andrew Carnegie. And so were the Rockefellers. The original Rockefellers and the Rockefeller family has been deeply involved in the occult for many, many generations. When you understand that, so much of what's going on in the world today begins to make sense. Otherwise, very little that's going on makes any sense. So pick up the story there.
I think that a lot of people, in the audience, a lot of Americans, they could say, listening to us right now, well, they don't see any evidence of this having gone on in education. And all I can say is that, yes, I think the reason that I became friendly with Norman Dodd was after 1985, especially when Ronald Reagan, the conservative, in quotes, president of the United States of America, signed the education agreements with the Soviet Union to merge the two education systems. Norman Dodd really, he always said he about fell off his chair when Rowan Gaither admitted to him that they got their instructions from the White House.
No, I think that for our listeners, Rowan Gaither was the president of the Ford Foundation.
Right.
Norman Dodd had gone to see him. And this was, of course, back in 1954, perhaps 1953 or 1954. And Rowan Gaither had said to him, I mean, why is Congress investigating the Ford Foundation? And before Mr. Dodd could answer, what did Rowan Gaither tell Norman Dodd at that time?
Well, you know, he just said that we here in the foundations, all of us here at the policymaking level of the foundations, have at one time or another served in the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, forerunner of the CIA, or the European Economic Administration, operating under directives from the White House. We operate under those same directives. The substance of the directives under which we operate is that we shall use our grant-making power to so alter life in the United States that we can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union.
And I think that's such an important thing that Rowan Gaither, the head of the Ford Foundation, told Norman Dodd that. And if you doubt that, why, of course, if you get our four-tape set on the secret government, you'll hear my interview with Norman Dodd back in 1980, where he tells that same story, how Rowan Gaither admitted that the whole purpose of their Ford Foundation was to so alter life in America that one day we could be peacefully merged with the Soviet Union. Of course, what he was really talking about was the coming New World Order and the New World Religion.
Exactly. Exactly what we're looking at right now, and which Gorbachev refers to, the European Union as the new European Soviet. And what George Bush is putting in here in this hemisphere is basically the new American Soviet under the guise of free trade, etc. And dropping borders, regionalism, government.
And I think that's so important that people understand the reason we are not trying to stop unbridled immigration from south of the border, and whether we have 15 or 20 million illegals here, it really doesn't matter. They have no intention of trying to stop the immigration. The president, the current administration, the INS is not allowed to stop immigration because they don't believe in borders. They want to unite Mexico, the United States, and Canada. When you understand that what's happening is not accidental, it's not that they're incompetent, is that they want, of course, to unite these nations. And, of course, then they can play one racial group against the other, create discord, and, as they have in France today, pretty soon bring about martial law. And today in France, they have for the equivalent of martial law, and it'll be extended out until February. But, of course, that's because they can play one group against the other. And that's what they intend to do here as we move from freedom to fascism, to the point where the freedom as we've known it in the past will simply very soon become the remembrance of things past. But you can't understand any of this unless you understand the spiritual forces that energize this whole movement towards the New World Order, the New World Religion. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Charlotte Isabey. And Charlotte had worked in the Department of Education as a senior analyst there during the Reagan administration until she found out what they were really up to. And, of course, she tried to tell President Reagan, and she was simply forced to resign from her position. But Charlotte has been trying ever since to educate the American people about the fact that most of what you think is really not true. That our educational system is not failing at all. It is succeeding in doing exactly what it was intended to do, and that is dumb down our young people. And then, of course, she had the opportunity of meeting with Norman Dodd, who was certainly one of my favorite people. He was the director of research for the Reese Committee. And then, of course, she has recently put up on a special webpage there. It's called AmericansDeception.com, and you want to go there. She's put up the Cox Committee report. This was 1952. The Reese Committee, 1953 and 1954. These reports, which have been actively suppressed by the establishment for 50 years. Why? Because the last thing they want the American people to know is that our great tax-exempt foundations were pushing communism and socialism, internationalism, had taken over control of our educational system, had rewritten our encyclopedias and our textbooks, and will you pick it up from there, Charlotte?
Yes, and as I said earlier, when Norman Dodd was, first of all, of course, shocked with a comment, the answer from Rowan Gaither of the Ford Foundation about the merger, actually the foundations being using their money to bring about a merger of the two countries. But he was very, very shocked, you know, although I don't think he was surprised, because he had been following the role of the foundations, Carnegie, Ford, etc., in the destruction of our American educational system, in the Sovietization of it. He had followed that up, you know, probably into the 70s, early 70s. And when he found out what Reagan had done, He was just appalled, and at that time we called him in. We had a ceremony for him in Washington, and in 1986, and we brought him. It was in the Congress, in the Senate Caucus Room. I remember he bought a new jacket, a tweed jacket, and he came in. He was quite elderly at that time, and we gave him an award. We called it the National Citizens Alliance Americanism Award, and it was presented by Senator Jesse Helms. And at the time, you know, Senator Helms got up and spoke, and he promised publicly, all of us, including Norman Dodd, that he would do everything within his power to reopen this investigation, which, of course, never happened.
Hold that thought right there, Charlotte. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Charlotte was telling about Norman Dodd, who she had an opportunity to meet some years after I did, and in 1986, why, they'd taken him to the Senate of the United States in one of the conference rooms. They had presented him with an award, because he was a great patriot and a great American, and Senator Jesse Helms had promised the people, and Norman Dodd and all the people gathered there, that he would get these hearings on investigating what the great tax-exempt foundations were doing, try to get those hearings reopened. But, of course, Senator Helms always said the right things, but so often he did the wrong things. So pick up the story there.
Yes, I will. And at that meeting, where we gave him this honor and this award, he said the following, and I'm going to read this. I put it in my book on page 266 of my book. And he said, this is Dodd speaking. Yeah. What is happening, I can best explain by describing to you where you would end up if you could sponsor a resumption of the inquiry into the effect of foundation-type organizations in this country. If that were to be done, you would come into possession of proof exposing a fundamental truth which has never been put into words. I shall try to recite that truth to you, and you could take it home and act on it as a premise. This truth is that whenever a people show by their actions that they prefer to think and act collectively, their dynasty becomes a reenactment of the story of the fall as told to us by God through Moses. We are now in a position where we can see that it is that dynastic effect which you are experiencing today. We have a task, and that task is to sponsor an inquiry which would pull out into the open the proofs which show that it is that dynasty that is being worked out by us as a people, unwittingly, in complete ignorance. I wish I could help you think about that truth, because it has never been put into circulation. It is now. It now deserves to be, and it is persons like yourselves who can contribute to the circulation of that particular finding which the foundations, in their zeal, have actually made understandable. They have made a mistake. The mistake they have made is now represented by their determination to cooperate with the Soviet Union educationally. Now, what he meant there was, he hoped, you see, that this would get out, what Reagan had done, and people would move on it. And he considered that a mistake because it became so blatant. But it didn't get out. And in fact, Human Events wouldn't even publish the article that I wrote in regard to the merger. Norman Dodd, that's a beautiful statement that he made. He had hoped, this was 1986, almost 20 years ago, that this would happen. I think this is, that, you know, having had the ceremony, knowing Norman Dodd, knowing what he said then, I just felt it was my responsibility to see that these hearings got up on the internet, so the American people, so the rest of the world can see what happened to America and how we are bringing the rest of the world down with us.
And in fact, there's a gentleman who knew Norman Dodd. His name escapes me right at the present time, but he told me he had a complete set of the hearings of the Rees Committee. And most of these hearings were simply either gotten or destroyed. Some man came to him and offered him, I've forgotten, thousands and thousands of dollars for his copy of the Rees Committee hearings, which, of course, had been initially given away free. But they wanted to get all of those off the market, just as they had done everything they could to suppress the book foundations, their power and influence, which we've kept in print for many years. Actually, I talked to Devin Garrity, who is the publisher of Devin Adair, and he told me that he'd published the book, but he couldn't get it distributed. It would get into libraries. People would buy it, put it into libraries, be taken off the shelves. And every time, of course, he would put into the list books in print, somebody would go into the books in print and simply remove that any reference to that book. And this is how, for so many years, they've kept the American people from understanding who it was who was really funding communism. I mean, we're supposed to think that the Soviet Union, which really has never been able to function efficiently, couldn't, had difficulty even feeding its own people, was able, of course, to create this tremendous military threat to the United States. It was all theoretical. It was all publicity. We saw these pictures of the missiles going down the streets, but they weren't really missiles. They were simply mock-up missiles, because we had to perceive there was an enemy there. So the American people would be willing to put out, their money and pay their tax money to build up the mightiest military in the world. Today, the United States military has as much money to spend as the next 20 nations in the world together. In other words, our military budget of over $400 billion is as much as the next 20 nations in the world together. And what is that money used for? Why, that money is used to get electronic apparatus and satellites, not to spy on the Russians, but to spy on the American people, to begin collecting dossiers on the American people, to begin to monitor the American people with our military intelligence. There are a lot of good, loyal Americans working in our military who know what's going on, but they don't have a voice, and that's why Charlotte and I have to be out there trying to educate the American people to understand that behind all of these things that are going on are far different forces than most people imagine. And what energizes this whole movement are powerful spiritual forces that, and Charlotte certainly knows about that because both her father and her grandfather were members of Skull and Bones. Go ahead, Charlotte.
Yes, that's true. And I must say that most that I ever learned about Skull and Bones, except for knowing my father's friends who were all members, because it's very secret and nothing was ever discussed at home in regard to it, it was through Anthony Sutton. The late Anthony Sutton, who wrote the wonderful book on the order at Yale. And, of course, that book, I helped him with that because I did happen to get the list of members when my father was dying. The first time they published the two books with the membership in it came, well, I was taking care of my dad, And Dad even commented. He said, "Oh, they've never done that before." And I gave those books to Anthony Sutton, and he said to me that he said after all these years of doing research, and he's working for the Hoover Institute, and he'd written that magnificent book, National Suicide, Military Aid to the Soviet Union, and he couldn't understand what we were doing, sort of what Dr. Stan was talking about, funding their military, funding everything to build them up, to create this enemy. And he put these books down that he went to Kinko's and got the and copied, and he put all the paper pages on his dining room table, and all these names popped out, and he said, then I knew. He said, I was able to figure out what I'd been asking myself all along, what is going on, because he saw all these families, these names connected, where they came from, who they were working with, what, and it just made sense. So, of course, the order is terribly, terribly important, and the last election was a rather unique one, where you had both candidates, members of the secret society. And I think that Anthony Sutton did a great service to all of us in regard to education in his book on the order.
It's called The American Establishment, yes. Incidentally. We do carry the book. Good. And, of course, Charlotte was good enough to let us borrow those books, too. And so we actually have the same list that Professor Sutton did, and we put it together, simply the membership list of the Skull and Bones, and I think the last one was 83. That was the latest list. And yet those are the people who today are in the White House of the United States.
Oh, absolutely. And what I wanted to say is the role of the order at Yale going over to Germany in the late 1800s. The professor is studying under Wilhelm Wundt, and this is my subject, and anybody who wants to go on my website and read my latest article on American education, Soviet style, and the research is there on the role of Wilhelm Wundt in changing our education system from academics to brainwashing through the use of the Pavlovian method. Now, interesting enough, Pavlov did not start this method. Wundt did. Pavlov studied under Wundt, but Sutton was great. I mean, he really got into that research, and he got all the names of the professors who went over and brought back this horrible system that John Dewey picked up in Thorndike and all of them, which is really nothing but dog training, which is, you know, stimulus, response, rewards, punishment. And that is the system, the Soviet system, being implemented right now in the United States. So that was a very important part of the order. If I think the most important thing the order ever did was to change American education from the great system that we had to basically the Soviet system, where there's really no education going on there. It's more training, but it's necessary for the global workforce, which is all we care about now, using our children as cogs in the global economy. But I also want to point out, Stan, that you've got a great gal out there, Susan O'Donnell. I'm sure a lot of people do know of Susan. She's a great researcher, and she's just recently come up. She lives out in Berkeley, and she has her National Monitor of Education in Berkeley, California. She's just done a wonderful newsletter, and it's called, it's a special library issue, What Happened to Mary and the Librarian, Part 1. And she's gone into the history of the American Library Association. People are wondering, what does this have to do with what we're talking about today? It has plenty, because she goes into the funding of the American Library Association, all of our libraries across the country. She's done an extraordinary job showing that they are federally funded, but mostly they are funded by the tax-exempt foundations. And I really hope that Susan's got enough of these copies available for people. I want you to be able to contact her. I don't know if she has, she doesn't have her telephone, but she has an email here. It's JSOOD. That stands for J S Susan O O D at AOL.com. And get that newsletter, because it's she also has mentioned in the back here, great news, Reese Committee hearings transcripts available online for the first time ever. But this is extraordinarily good newsletter, And we all know the evil that has been wrought by the American Library Association. But she goes way back into the history of it. She tells us who was involved. She discusses UNESCO's role. She discusses the foundation role. And all I can say is, good for Susan. Hooray.
And I think what you have to understand is that what they effectively do is determine which books are going to be in the library, and you're not going to find the books that will really tell you the truth, or if you can get them, they're very hard to get. For instance, Professor Quigley's book, Transient Hope and the History of the World in Our Time, they can probably get it from another library, but it's not going to be something you're ever going to hear about, or the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence. The book written by Rennie Wormser on the Great Tax Exempt Foundations, which was really the best source of information before they put this the full committee hearings up there on the internet. So important books that really tell you the truth about what's going on are censored by the American Library Association. I know in my community they were simply burning books and they were throwing them into the trash so they could destroy them. Those are books they weren't going to put out for the people to be able to buy. They just wanted to get rid of them. And this happens all across America, because if you can control what people read, you can ultimately control what people believe, and really that you control the reality. So the Library Association has been so vitally important in manipulating the reality of the American people to embrace these socialist concepts and to be willing to accept ever more government control over our lives in the name of opposing the wicked capitalists, without ever realizing it was the wicked capitalists who were pushing the socialist concept. Because under our form of government, you limited the power of federal government. And that's the one thing that the elite did not want. They wanted all power in Washington.
Well, it's very it's tragic when you think of the results of the American Library Association's efforts, because they their goal really has been to replace good literature with trash and pornography and everything that is totally destructive of our children's values and their minds. And they have, you know, every year, I'm sure all of you have this happening, you know, they have a little book banning month, and they go up against all of these parents who are called, we're the book burners, really. So we're the censors, because we really do not want our children to be exposed to pornography. And the books that they have available for the children in the library are absolutely inappropriate. They have a great deal to do with what goes on even in the schools. I was surprised, and I guess I shouldn't have been. Having read Susan's newsletter, I see that I was quite correct, and Susan evidently pulled this information up as well. In my office, as senior policy advisor, we had in the Office of Educational Research and Improvement an Office of Libraries and Learning Technologies as well. And I found a very important grant, I think was a proposal or money to go to the local libraries. I had not realized that, that my office was funding the local libraries across the United States. And one of the particular papers that I got a hold of that I managed to lose, one of the papers I did manage to lose, too bad, dealt with how to keep traditional American constitutional volumes and books out of the libraries, and how to ban anything written by Phyllis Schlafly or any of the conservatives who were, you know, for instance, child abuse in the classroom. Make sure that book never got in there. That was the hearings that we had for the Protection of People Rights Amendment, and I had been very involved in that. So I was shocked when I read that. They mentioned a lot of noted conservatives whose writings should not be allowed in the libraries of the United States. I'm sorry I lost that document. It would have been a beauty to have put into my book. But the American Library Association, funded by the Ford Foundation, Carnegie, all of them, has been for years and years and years, goes way back, 100 years or so. Please do remember, there you are in California, all of you good people out there still fighting in California. I'll give you Susan's email again. It's jsood@aol.com. And you might want to, she's got another issue coming up. It's a two-part issue, this one called What Happened to Marion, the Librarian. I think Marion, the Librarian, was a relative of Susan's. But she says this will be concluded in part two, the November-December issue. So make sure that you email Susan and get this information that she is taking her own time, her own money and all, to get out to the American people.
Well, maybe we can get Susan onto our program.
I was going to suggest that.
I think it's so vitally important that people understand that they are focusing our children's attention on pornography and depravity and doing everything they can to undermine their faith in God and in family and country. And if you read some of the books that are being given to children in private Christian schools, you can't imagine how bad they are. Imagine how bad they are in the public schools. When the ones I got from the private Christian school where my granddaughter was going, at least one book. After reading that book, you just felt like the only way out was suicide. And then after, our kids know a lot more about suicide than they do about Shakespeare. We'll be back in just a moment here with Charlotte Isabey to wrap up this program. And remember, you want to go to her website, pull down the information, and learn about what the Reese Committee found 50 years ago that they don't want you to know. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening. Fascinating hour with Charlotte Isabey. It was good enough to stay up late tonight to be with us. So, Charlotte, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up tonight's program.
Okay. Well, I want people to go to this new website, and also Don Bell supporters, lovers, a wonderful Don Bell report. I have up on that new website, I have some of his major reports, not all of them. I want to get as much up there as I can. He was a fabulous correspondent during World War II in the Pacific and turned in a concentration camp. He was a journalist, he got out and he started his newsletter, and really it's remarkable. It's sort of a history of a country and from 1950 on.
And maybe you ought to get the old Dan Smoot reports out.
I'm going to try to do that as well. So the name of the website where you're going to get the Reese Committee and the Cox Committee reports is really pretty easy to remember. It's AmericanDeception.com.
And, of course, everything has been built upon deception. They could not let the American people understand that people of great wealth were pushing socialism. And, you know, well, why would people of great wealth want to push socialism? Isn't socialism about redistributing the wealth of the wealthy? No. It's about redistributing the wealth of the middle class and centralizing power in the hands of at least a small group of wealthy people. There are lots of wealthy people, who are not part of this. But the wealthiest people are, because, of course, they have had, in my estimation, supernatural help in accumulating their vast, vast fortunes.
Well, the other thing is I go on my my other website for my book is deliberatedumbingdown.com. And that I hope you'll go to, and I hope you... Oh, wait a minute. I forgot to tell people. Wait a minute. My book, through the year, through December 31st, during the holiday season, Christmas season, is half price.
And, because this is going to be on a non-commercial station, so cost the... you can go to Charlotte's website and take a look at and learn about her book.
Right. And as far as this, the Tax Exempt Foundation's report and the Good Night and Good Luck... the movie about Edward R. Murrow. Go to the movie. Keep in mind this information that you're going to read regarding the Reese Committee, and also in regard to the Venona Secrets, that marvelous book exposing Soviet espionage and America's traitors. Because Good Night and Good Luck, again, it's an attack on Joseph McCarthy and how Edward R. Murrow was really the leader, the ringleader there. And then the Venona Secrets will teach you that Joseph McCarthy was absolutely correct. But the point is, here we are in the year 2005. We have the movie industry.
We're out of time, Charlotte. Good night.
Yep. Good. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye, and thank you so much for being with us.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course that was Charlotte Isabey, and of course her website is deliberatedumbingdown.com. That's deliberatedumbingdown.com or www.americandeception.com. And I think that you will be fascinated to understand what she's trying to get out. And, of course, much of this is covered in a book we've kept in print for many years called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. And that is that communism was never the enemy. Oh, yes, there were communists who hated America. There were communists who would plot against America. But at the very, very top, there was a small group of people who were part of what I call the occult hierarchy of the world. people are energized by spiritual forces. And until you understand that behind everything there are spiritual forces. In fact, we've taken together put together a number of my newsletters into a little series of pamphlets called The Occult Hierarchy Part 1, Part 2, and Part 3. Now you can pull those down off the internet at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. If you're interested in the pamphlets, you can always give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to understand why your electricity bill is going to be going up this winter and your natural gas bill and the cost of heating oil, why, of course, you want to get our latest newsletter. It's called Peak Oil 2, and it will be available upon their internet site in the next day or two. That's at radioliberty.com. But if you don't have access to a computer or you have not been in touch with our ministry before, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send you free of charge a copy of our latest newsletter, which gives you an overview of one of the greatest scams ever put out to any civilized people. And that is that oil comes from decayed dinosaurs, and we're running out of dinosaurs, so there just isn't going to be any more oil. Oil is a finite substance, and, well, if you read my newsletter, you'll find out that most everything you've ever learned in geology and you've been told for years just isn't true. So if you'd like to get a free copy of our Peak Oil 2 newsletter, and of course it goes into the background of how they have created an artificial shortage of natural gas, how they've created an artificial shortage of oil, which transports into gasoline and diesel, and of course jet fuel, which is driving up the price of the airline travel, and of course many of our airlines will eventually go bankrupt and be probably bought up by the people who created the whole problem to begin with. You need to understand that behind everything that goes on, there are powerful spiritual forces that energize so much what goes on in the world today. And so go to our website, radioliberty.com, pull down our newsletters, listen to our programs there 5 hours a day. Pull down, you can get our archive programs as well. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. And then, of course, please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. If you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us, and quite frankly, we do need your help to maintain the 60 stations we're on each week, why, we'd love to hear from you. Until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but please don't call unless we specifically request calls, because we have with us on the line Danella Weaver, who's from Bellingham, Washington, and Danella is a housewife with children, and yet, sure, she has gotten involved in the battle in her community to try to prevent mandatory fluoridation of the water supply. And the people on the other side, the people of great wealth and the medical and public health establishment and dental establishment, have put up over $260,000 that we know of to force the people to have fluoridated water. And Danella and the people that she represents had raised it at the most about $15,000. So it was really a sort of a David and Goliath situation. And Danella, what's happened up there with that vote coming down the line?
Well, we've had very good news. We are currently over 1,000 votes ahead of the opposition. And so it just goes to show you that sometimes the little guy can win.
And, of course, what are there, only about 20,000 votes there all told in the county?
In the city.
In the city, okay. Now, is it a separate city and county election, or is it basically just a city they're trying to fluoridate?
It's just a city right now.
All right, fine. So it looks like things are going pretty well right now at the present time. Now, why don't you tell our listeners how you got involved in this whole battle?
Well, this is about the third time that I know of that they've tried to fluoridate Bellingham. And the last time, back in 97, I wasn't for fluoridation, but mainly it was because of, I thought it was wasteful. When I saw the yard signs in Bellingham again, I thought, oh no, it's come up again. And this time, I started doing research. My husband and myself, we started doing research, and we were just appalled at the information that we uncovered. Information like the source of the fluoride and the damage that it can do, which growing up with Crest commercials and the belief that, well, fluoride's good for you, right? I never would have guessed that fluoride was linked to so many problems.
And, of course, the trouble is that the average person doesn't get up on the Internet. They don't get the information. Or if they do get there, why, of course, they're misled. There is an organized effort to conceal the truth from the American people. For instance, Dr. Paul Conant, a well-known chemist, has put up a website, fluoridealert.org, giving you access to all of the various places you could go to learn about this terrible, terrible poison that they're putting in the water. Because it's not simply fluoride. It includes arsenic and lead and polonium-20 and cadmium, as I remember, because it's really hydrofluorosilicic acid. It's not fluoride that they're putting in the water. Less than half of it, or just about half of it's fluoride. The rest is all sorts of other terrible poisons. But really, even more than that, fluoridealert.org went up and people began going to it. So the American Dental Association put up fluoridealert.com, hoping you would go there by mistake, and then you would go to their website that tells you how wonderful water fluoridation is. Did you run into that, Danella?
I was informed of that, and so I checked it out for myself. And sure enough, I did come across the ADA information. And so it would be a very easy mistake for somebody to put .com by mistake.
And the one thing they don't want is for the American people to learn the truth. If we're going to get into that truth this evening with Danelle, is it Danelle or Danella?
Danelle.
Danelle, okay. But Danelle Weaver, who's been leading the battle up there in Bellingham, and God bless her for doing it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Danelle Weaver, and of course, if you'd like to read a little bit about Donnell and the battle that's been going on up there, there's an article in Time magazine, the 24th of October of this year, that tells you that the 7,000 employees of the Environmental Protection Agency had petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency through their union to stop all water fluoridation because it's a poison and it's dangerous, and yet it was the only place I saw in all the newspapers and magazines I have read on a daily basis any mention of the fact that 7,000 employees of the Environmental Protection Agency have petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency to stop poisoning the public. Well, they just said to stop water fluoridation, but that's in essence why it was. And of course, we'll be talking more of what that was all about later on. But you'll read a little bit about the battle up there in Bellingham and really how this is important. They put an awful lot of money into trying to win the election, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Over $250,000 went into this election. And that's just a tremendous sum, especially when you figure that not a dime of it went to help actually treat any of the kids that they're saying that this is supposed to be helping.
Well, who put up the money, do we know?
Organizations like the Washington Dental Foundation, Washington State Dental Association, and other organizations of that sort.
Did the American or the Washington Medical Association put up any money, or did any of the fertilizer producers put it up, or the people who are trying to get rid of the toxic waste that's so toxic they can't put it into a dump, so they're going to put it in your drinking water?
Right. Well, they did not donate directly to Bellingham Families for Fluoride, but whether they donated to, say, the American Dental Association or other organizations like that, I can't say.
But anyway, they put up over $250,000 to try to do it, to force the people there to have their water fluoridated. Most of the communities up there in Washington are fluoridated, or not very many of them?
Oh, I believe it's less than half. Good. In Washington State.
Well, I just hope that you can, of course, spread your information to other communities, and that's why I do what I do. Because I think it's important that people understand they're poisoning our people. There's no question they're poisoning our people. The studies are there. Go to fluoridealert.org and read all of the scientific studies that you will never see mentioned by PubMed. You will never see mentioned by the medical letter. You will never see mentioned in dental organization publications or medical publication, because there's an organized effort to keep the truth from the dentists, from the doctors, from the public all across America. But we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and now why don't you tell our listeners then what you've learned as you began to study this issue?
Well, one thing that astonished me was the source of the fluoride. I always assumed that it was basically the same stuff that's in toothpaste. Otherwise, they wouldn't allow it, right? And that's what I was always thinking, and I discovered that it's a byproduct of the phosphate fertilizer industry, and it comes straight from the smokestacks. So they can't release it into the rivers or lakes. They can't release it into the air, but they can take that contaminated gunk and put it into our drinking water.
And what does it contain?
Lead, arsenic, mercury. The list goes on.
But there's no safe level of lead that according to the Environmental Protection Agency, there's no safe level of lead to be put in water.
Exactly. But yet they're able to get away with it.
And they get away with it because there is an organized effort to keep the American people from realizing what's happened. Well, what sort of complications come when you put this sort of a combination into the drinking water? Does it have an effect on people's health?
Well, I think it's pretty common knowledge these days about the damage that lead, arsenic, and mercury can do to children. For example, lead is well known to be neurological. It causes neurological damage to children permanently. And so that alone should be enough to say to some people, gee, that shouldn't go in our water.
But, I mean, is it really damaging our children? Is there any evidence that our children are damaged?
There are studies on lead and arsenic and mercury that have been ongoing for years. Unfortunately, I don't have the specific studies with me.
Well, I will tell you that one in six American children either has a neurodevelopmental or behavioral abnormality. We have rising levels of autism, ADD, ADHD, Asperger's disease, learning disability, reading disability, a mathematical disability, and these children's brains have been permanently damaged. And it's only been in recent years. And, of course, nobody wants to try to figure out why. When our kids get through the fourth grade and they have tests comparing them with the kids throughout the rest of the world, our kids don't do very well. By the time they get through the eighth grade, why, they do even poor. By the time they graduate from high school and we compare our high school graduates with graduates from the rest of the world, our kids can't compete at all. That's the great tragedy of today. Their minds are being permanently damaged. And the fact that most people don't understand that these products that they're putting in the water affect the mind. And there have been all sorts of studies, and anybody wants to verify that. Do you have any sources of information at all, Danelle, where people can go and get that information?
Well, fluoridealert.org is an excellent site for any of the information regarding contaminants on within the fluoridated compounds. I don't even like to call it fluoride because it is just, the fluoride in it is such a minute part of this toxic stew that's being put into our drinking water. Keepersofthewell.org is an excellent site as well.
All right, that's fluoridealert.org and keepersofthewell.org, two excellent websites, one by Dr. Paul Conant, the other by Jeff Green, which is a group that is really trying to educate the American people about the fact that they're poisoning our children. Of course, they're poisoning the adults, too. Are there any other complications besides the metal changes that come with the fluoride in the water? Does it have any other pharmacological effects you can think of?
Well, particularly with regards to children, one thing that comes to mind is fluorosis. Now, there's dental fluorosis and there's skeletal fluorosis. With dental fluorosis, you might see children or even adults who have grown up in fluoridated communities with white or brown spots or streaks or bands or even pits in their teeth. And that is a sign of fluoride overdose. They got too much fluoride when their teeth were developing, and that is the most obvious physical sign.
All right, fine. And of course, skeletal fluorosis, well, you have to get a fair amount of fluoride before you'll get the skeletal fluorosis, although certainly in areas where there's a great deal of fluoride in the water, you do get it, and the bones get chalky white, and they begin to bend, and they get all sorts of deformities to their back, and stunts their growth, and all sorts of things of that sort. Well, what about the incidence influence on fertility? Did you find that there were any studies that suggested that fluoride decreased fertility?
Yes, there's particularly in animal studies, I have seen various studies that show lowered fertility in both men and women. And it's, for example, it affects men's sperm count, and it can damage, it can, for example, cross the placenta into the developing fetus, and it can harm a developing child.
But why would they put anything in the water that would harm a developing child? That doesn't quite make sense.
No, it doesn't. I've wondered that myself. But I suppose if somebody wants to find a place to get rid of a toxin, they can create a way to spin it to make it seem like it's a really good idea.
Well, of course, these studies, there was a Dr. Prenny who did a study back in 1994, and he was simply a scientist, and he was comparing the fertility rates in fluoridated and non-fluoridated areas, and he found a very definite causal relationship between water fluoridation and fertility rates. If you had increased the fluoride in the water, the fertility went down. If you decreased the fluoride in the water, the fertility went up. And Dr. Prenny was actually threatened and told not to publish his publication, but he actually did, and the information is there. In fact, we have that in our hidden agenda syllabus, and of course we know it influences sperm mobility, sperm counts, and there's of course an increased influence of Down's disease in areas where the water is fluoridated, but nobody ever mentions that. So, well, basically, how did you mount your attack. How did you, your group, and I assume that you were probably mostly non-professional people who were just trying to get the truth out to the people. Did you get a fair break as far as the newspaper is concerned? Would they present both sides, or like most newspapers, did they simply slant the news against you?
Well, our main newspaper in town, the Bellingham Herald, heavily endorsed the other side, even before it became an official ballot measure. And so we had our work cut out for us. We mounted a writing campaign. We encouraged everyone to write in and in support of our side. And other publications in the county, such as the Bellingham Weekly and the Whatcom Independent, really took the time to learn about the fluoridation issue and presented much more balanced and informative pieces.
And I think that's, you'll find that almost any place in the country. Many times the small weeklies will give you the honest truth, whereas most of the major newspapers, you know, in every state are biased. I know I ran into this one time. We were pushing a ballot initiative back in 1988, Prop 102. And going into the election, 5, 10 days before the election, we had 60% of the people on our side and 30% against us. 65%, 35, I think it was. And then, of course, the newspapers came on with a big propaganda campaign. And we lost, instead of winning 2-1, we lost 2-1. So I wrote to 100 newspapers in California to see what their position was. And all but 3 were on the other side. Actively campaigned against the logical approach to addressing the AIDS epidemic. It had to do with treating AIDS as any other disease and make it reportable. But, of course, there was no intention to allow us to stop the AIDS epidemic any more than there's any intention to allow the people not to have their water fluoridated, even though you're putting a deadly poison into the water. Well, then, of course, what happened? How were you able to get the dentists and the medical professionals and the public health officials to enter into a debate with you? Because ordinarily they'll say, why, there's no reason to debate this. The decision has already been made. This has been authorized by the U.S. Public Health Service and by the Federal Drug Administration, by the Environmental Protection Agency that are here to protect your health. Why, we would never do anything to hurt children. We just want to help children. So how did you get around that?
Well, we really mounted what would be a classic grassroots campaign. We started at the market. We got the word out. We encouraged letter writing. And we did start having debates. And, in fact, we had one with Dr. Paul Connett, and which was wonderful. And we had invited the other side to attend, but they chose not to.
Now,
and
to our listeners, Dr. Paul Connett is a professor of chemistry at one of the major universities. Whereabouts is he? I don't recall offhand.
He's at St. Lawrence University in New York.
Okay, St. Lawrence. He's a professor. He understands how terribly toxic this is. All the chemists understand that. But they're not allowed a voice. They have a peer-reviewed magazine called Fluoride. You will never see it. You know, it's very, very difficult to find on the Internet. You actually can find it on the Internet. But they've done everything to prevent people from finding it. They've certainly done a pretty good job of burying it. But anyway, what happened when Dr. Connett came to town?
Well, the other side didn't want to show up. So, in their place, Dr. Connett had this very adorable chicken. I don't remember, crocheted or knitted. And he set it in the place of honor where the seats had been set aside for the pro-fluoridationists, and he proceeded to debate this chicken. And word got out. And it sort of evolved into where it became a joke that
there were chickens on the other side. In other words, the people who were supporting the fluoridation were chickens.
Yes, exactly. And lo and behold, we were able to get them to start getting them to forums. And the ones particularly sponsored by the Weekly and such, that we were able to have both sides presented.
I see. Now, were you getting people out to the meetings? Because, of course, you know, it's so hard sometimes to get people to come to meetings. But did people begin to show up when they realized what was really at stake?
Yes, I think once word started to spread and they realized this was happening again, you know, this is the third time since 92 and 97, and people were tired of it. They didn't want to go through this again. They'd already said no. And that got people's dander up, and they decided to start doing something. And
hold
they told
hold
their
that
friends,
right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Danelle Weaver from Bellingham, Washington, and she and a small group of people up there launched a campaign to oppose water fluoridation. Now, you're not a political activist, are you, Danelle?
No, in fact, this is my first political campaign I have ever done.
And your mother, how many children do you have?
I have two boys, 10 and 8.
All right, fine. Well, for their sake, if nothing else, why, you certainly don't want to have fluoridated water.
Exactly.
Because, ladies and gentlemen, it does affect the mind, it affects the fertility, it increases the incidence of cancer, it softens the bone, it affects the thyroid, it upsets the endocrine system, it increases the incidence of heart disease, and that's just a few of the beneficial effects. Let me tell you the bad things about it. You really need to understand that there is no justification for this. None of the countries in Europe allow water fluoridation. Well, of course, they do that. And, of course, in Ireland, about 50-60% of Ireland is fluoridated. And, of course, the communists did fluoridate Eastern Europe. But once, of course, communism fell, why they stopped fluoridating Eastern Europe. And you'd never guess what happened. The incidence of dental cavities went down in East Germany after they stopped fluoridating the water. So most of what you think you know about water fluoridation just isn't true. But it's, of course, one of the greatest scams and most dangerous things that has ever been done here in the United States. Well, now, of course, as the campaign advanced and the people on the other side came, what sort of arguments did they use in favor of water fluoridation?
Oh, the same one that shows up every time. Safe and effective, safe and effective. Oh, the CD says it's one of the 10 great wonders. They just repeat the same things over and over again, hoping that if they say it enough, people will believe them.
Well, of course, they show those pictures of these horrible-looking teeth that they have in areas where, of course, the children do not have fluoridated water?
Well, what they've done here is shown pictures, like, for example, at forums, of baby bottle tooth decay and say that, oh, well, if we had fluoridation, we wouldn't have children with this kind of decay, which is outright fraud.
What you really need to do is get a set of those pictures and say, this is what the sort of appearance you get in areas where they have water fluoridation. That would just drive them crazy because, actually, of course, in areas where they have water fluoridation, there's no decrease in the incidence of dental cavities.
Exactly.
And it's all a lie, but a lie told often enough often comes to be believed.
Right. And that's what they do. They say the same things over and over and over again. And they throw out safe and effective, which it's neither.
Well, of course, the thing to do when they say it's safe, ask them why in the original study there in Newburgh, New York, the girls had a premature menarche by 6 or 8 months. If it had no physiological effect, why was there twice the incidence of heart disease in Newburgh, New York, than in the comparison town of Kingston, New York? But, really, of course, it takes a lot of time to get all of the facts together. Have you read that wonderful book, Chris Bryson's book, The Fluoride Deception?
Well, I've gotten started through it many times, and I end up loaning it out every time. So I have yet to finish that whole book. It is a wonderful book. But I felt the loaning out was more important, and I'm still bound and determined to finish it. And I'm sure next time I start to read it, somebody will ask to borrow it again.
Well, I think you're just going to have to tell them to go ahead and get a copy of the
book. Exactly.
I never lend out a book because whenever I lend out a book, they never come back again. You're lucky you get your books back. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Well, our guest this evening is Danelle Weaver, and we're talking about water fluoridation. 67% of our water supplies in the United States are fluoridated today. In China, they're trying to get the fluoride out of the water because, of course, they found out in the areas where you had fluoridated water why the average young person lost 10 to 15 points in their IQ. The same thing is true in India. And, of course, we have a syllabus where we have letters from the public health officers in India and China and Japan and Europe. And none of them will allow water fluoridation because they know what it does to the mind, to the body. They know it's a deadly poison. So, but then, of course, the dentists are going to say, but look what's happened to the oral health. Oral health has improved over the last 50 years. And how do you respond to that, Danelle?
Well, if you were to look at a chart that showed all of the countries, fluoridated and non-fluoridated, on the same chart, you would see that every single one of them has gone down in the amount of decay in their citizens. It makes no difference in the whether they are fluoridated or not. Everybody is experiencing the same reduction in decay rate, regardless of fluoridation.
And that's absolutely true. In fact, oral health is far better today than it was 50 years ago in areas of the United States with fluoridated water and in areas of the United States without fluoridated water. And in countries of Europe without fluoridated water, and in every developed country of the world now, why is fluoridated? Why has oral health improved? Do you have any idea?
Well, there's education. There's more products available all around the world for people to use. Better products, wider variety. We've got sealants on teeth. We've got a variety of rinses and even a variety of fluoridated or non-fluoridated toothpaste. And so we can't just say, oh, it's the water fluoridation. It's a variety of things all working together to reduce the decay rate.
But, of course, if there's no difference in fluoridated areas or non-fluoridated areas as far as the water fluoridation, then why do they want to fluoridate the water?
Well, because they have a product that they need to get rid of. Like I said before, they couldn't dump it in the rivers. They can't release it into the air. And if they have to haul it off, they have to haul it off as hazardous waste. But once it's sold, it becomes a product, and therefore it can be shipped across the United States and not treated as hazardous waste.
And, of course, this is the product that comes from the scrubbings of the chimneys of phosphate fertilizer plants. And, of course, here is where you come in to get the lead and the arsenic and the cadmium and the polonium-20, and as well as the fluoride. And, of course, they can't vent it into the air because it's against the rules of the Environmental Protection Agency. They certainly couldn't put it into a lake or a river because it's too toxic. And, of course, you can't store it indefinitely because it's so toxic it'll eat through the metal. And, of course, you know, toxic dumps are really very, very expensive because it is one of the most toxic substances in the world. So they came up with a wonderful idea. And the wonderful idea was to put it in the drinking water. But why does the government go along with that? You would think there'd be some people in government that would point out that this is a deadly poison they're putting in, and there are physiological effects, and the scientific studies of the fluoridated areas show that it has a toxic effect on the people. So why doesn't anybody in the government speak out?
Well, those that do speak out typically get fired. And their jobs, their careers are ruined, whether it be scientists or whoever else comes forward and says this is wrong and here's why, they have no career.
And of course, this has really happened to a number of people. Dr. Marcus, William Marcus worked, he was the senior toxicologist in the Department of Water Safety at the Environmental Protection Agency. And when he objected to the fact that they'd altered a study that showed that water fluoridation produced cancer in animals, why they fired him. Fortunately, he did get his job back. He had to sue and mortgage his house to get his job back. But, of course, that was a pretty good lesson to the other people. Dr. Phyllis Mullinex at Harvard University found the effect of water fluoridation on animals and how it altered the brains and minds of the offspring of the rats that she was studying. And of course, she was told not to publish the paper. When she did, she lost her position at the Forsyth Dental Center there, affiliated with Harvard University, and sort of became a non-person. Dr. Harvey Limebach, professor of preventive dentistry at the University of Toronto, came forward to tell people what was going on. I personally talked to him. He told me he'd been threatened, and of course, as he said, I'm not willing to risk my job and my family on this issue, but you can read what I've already set up. It's on the internet, and of course we actually have videos with him and articles by him telling you how deadly this is. But they actually threaten people who try to tell the American people the truth, and we can give you so many other examples of Dr. Freddie, who did the studies on fertility. And well, we're going to be back in just a moment. We welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Janelle Weaver, and she's from Bellingham, Washington, and they've been involved in a battle up there to keep the fluoride out of their water. The other side put up $250,000. The people on her side put up $15,000, and it looked like they're winning. They're 1,000 votes ahead right now. And if they have, if the election, I think, is honest, why, hopefully this will put it to bed for, but do you think they'll be back again? It seems that these people are determined to fluoridate your drinking water.
Yes, I definitely think they'll be back. I know they'll be back. And in the meantime, they're also going for a neighboring county, Skagit County. There's already word of two or three other cities that they're going to target next. And we know for sure that sooner or later they're going to hit the state legislature.
And
so they won't give up.
And of course, that's what they've done here in California. Since they couldn't get it through the various states, they went to the state legislature, where we have some of the finest politicians that money could buy, and they got the state legislators to say it doesn't matter what the people want.
No.
Why, we know what's best for them, and we're going to fluoridate the water. And of course, there is another agenda behind that. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But the thing is that there's a great deal at stake here, and the last thing they can allow is for the American people to realize that they are intentionally and knowingly poisoning our children. And when 7,000 employees of the Environmental Protection Agency petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency to stop all water fluoridation, and not only one article that I've seen anyway on the internet or any other place, and of course that one article was in Time magazine on the 24th of October of this year, 2005, told the truth. And the rest of it was totally ignored. Did you actually talk to that reporter from Time magazine who wrote the article?
Yes, I did. She was in at our house and interviewed my husband and myself. And I can tell you, I was very nervous about that.
Well, I would be too, anybody from Time magazine, but I thought that she gave a fairly fair appraisal of both sides of the issue.
She was wonderful to work with, put me at ease. And I was very pleased with the outcome of the article.
And so, and if you haven't actually read that article, Time magazine, October 24th, you can get one at your local library. If you have difficulty, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we'll be glad to help you try to get a copy of that article. I think it's a very important article because it presents both sides of the issue. But you think, the thing is, you can go up on the internet to Dr. Paul Conant's website, and there are references to literally hundreds of articles telling you how they're poisoning our children, articles which the other side does not want you to know about. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Janelle Weaver, and she's from Bellingham, Washington, and she's been on the front lines of this battle. How long have you been in the battle? How long is it there was the electoral process this time?
Well, I can tell you personally that we got involved at the beginning of the summer this year, and our lives haven't been the same since. 1 to 2 hours of research a day, going to farmers markets, handing out flyers, and thank goodness I have such wonderful people on the team to work with. Otherwise, I don't think I would have survived it.
How large a team did you have?
Well, we had about 6 people, and that's about it, really, of the really active people involved in the decision-making and planning and actually getting things done.
Now, what about the raising of the $15,000? Now, I've actually been out, you know, tried to raise funds in the past. I find it's pretty hard to get people to put up money for anything.
It really is. Now, that $15,000 is divided between 3 groups. My particular group raised about $7,000 altogether. 1,000 of that came from the IAOMT, which is the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology.
And that's Dr. David Kennedy's group. Dr. Kennedy's been a frequent guest of ours. Go ahead.
And so without them, we would not have been able to get a particular mailer out to the precincts that we were targeting. So we've had donations from Colorado and Texas, and the support from neighbors and friends, and people just sending in surprise donations. You know, $50 here, $100 there. It's just been amazing, the support.
Well, I think it's really wonderful, and the fact that you were able then to utilize that money wisely, target specific areas, and begin to reach the people. You see, people depend upon the newspaper. When the newspapers are going to lie to you, then how do you get to them? Well, of course, you can do direct mailing. Did you use a direct mailing? Did you actually use the bulk mail rates or regular mail rates?
We went with the mailing service, designed a postcard, and worked with another political action committee to get out a mailer right before the election. And then, but the main thing was, for our group, was the radio ads. Another group targeted newspaper ads. So we tried to work together, the different political action committees, to make our budgets last just a little bit longer.
And I think, of course, radio ads are really a wonderful, wonderful thing. I mean, you reach an awful lot of people that way, but then you have to get mailings, you have to get certainly the newspaper ads. You've got to hit them from all points of view. So people begin to realize that there really is a controversy. The other side, and I call them the wicked people, want to give you the idea that this is already a scientific certainty. It is a scientific certainty. It's a scientific certainty that they're hurting our children. And, of course, they're hurting our people. But the average American feels that's so absurd, they cannot believe that the U.S. Public Health Service would allow something like that, or the Centers for Disease Control. Well, of course, some people refer to them as the Centers for Disease Corruption or Centers for Disease Cover-Up. I've been there, I've talked to the people, and I will tell you, at the Centers for Disease Control, I talked to some of the wickedest people I've ever met. And they were there, of course, doing everything they could to block an effective approach to the AIDS epidemic, because that was my concern. But other people who have been there for other reasons have come up with exactly the same conclusion. After all, if you want to do harm, what better place to be than in the high position as far as government is concerned? So I think it's vitally important that people understand that we're going to have to make up our decisions as a local community, and people are going to have to be involved. And this is really a great issue. Did you think you changed anybody's mind on this issue, that we're wavering one way or the other?
Yes. I've had experiences, and other volunteers have had similar experiences of talking to people one-on-one, for example, at our farmer's market, and speaking to them one-on-one and actually being able to get past the hype that the other side's putting out and give them the real information and be able to send them home with packets of information. We had a lot of information available to people.
Did you have any help from any of the dentists? Were any of them have the courage to tell the truth? Because some dentists know what's going on, but they know they will be attacked and vilified if they tell the truth.
Right. We had help from doctors associated with the IAOMT, such as Dr. Paul Rubin, who works mainly in Seattle and one day a week up in Bellingham. And he was very helpful on many occasions. But for the most part, we do know of other dentists that have talked to us who were not willing to come forward for fear of persecution.
I know what a terrible thing it is in America when dentists are afraid to come out and tell the truth for fear of persecution. The fear that they'll be discriminated against or demonized, or it'll hurt their practice, or maybe they'll even go out of their dental license. Could this sort of thing happen in America? Would these people who are poisoning the water go to that length to conceal the truth? And I would like to suggest that absolutely they would do that. And so dentists and many times doctors are afraid. But then, of course, you know, it was Dante who told us in his classic, The Inferno, that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a time of moral crisis, maintain a position of neutrality. And this battle over water fluoridation, there is no neutral position. You're going to have to be on one side or the other, because it's
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm.